It's just after 9 a.m, one hot August morning in 2016, when three MI5 officers arrived at an address on Florence Street, central Birmingham. It's a scruffy side road with tatty industrial units used by mechanics, fast food suppliers, and at number 14, a parcel delivery company. The officers have arrived to install a bugging device inside a car belonging to a young Muslim man called Navid Ali. As they are doing so, they spot a plastic bag tucked under the car's driving seat. One of the officers carefully opens it to reveal a roll of gaffer tape. It's attached to the handle and trigger of a handgun. Then he sees a pipe. The bomb squad is called and the area evacuated. The bag also contains a meat cleaver. The word kafir, meaning unbeliever in Arabic, is scratched into the blade. A group of men are arrested on terrorism charges. It's a success story for MI5, an imminent terror attack averted. Or at least that's how the official story goes. But there is another story, a much more sinister story, one which is full of holes and inconsistencies.
Can you believe it that we've got all of this staring, literally, it's glaring at me right now. And it's been glaring at everyone all these years and still, yeah, we're stuck in the system.
This unofficial story is one of police corruption and fabrication, of lies and planting evidence, and if true, a uniquely appalling miscarriage of justice. We're taught to believe that our justice system is fair, that everyone is equal in the eyes of the law, and that it's almost impossible for an innocent person to go to prison for a crime they didn't commit. Because the alternative is just too awful to imagine. These are the stories of people who maintain their innocence and yet remain in prison, fighting unimaginable odds to win justice in a system that, many would say, is rigged against them. This podcast tells the stories of those on the outside fighting to free those on the inside. I'm Marnie Duke, and this is The Overturn. Today I'm in Birmingham to find out more about the men convicted of plotting the terrorist attack, but who have always maintained their innocence.
I'm Maram Hussein. I'm the sister of Hubeib Hussein of the Birmingham Four.
The story starts 6 years earlier, in August 2011. At 18 years old, Hubeib and his friend Navid made the decision to go to Pakistan with the intention of attending a terrorist training camp.
It was a quite large case. I can't remember the exact number of men now, but it was about 9 or 10 men. But let's just say my brother was the youngest. I believe it was Ramadan, and we had thought he was going to a different city to attend a mosque, and it's quite typical you do that in the last 10 days of Ramadan. However, it then became, I'm not sure who found out first, but it was clear that they were not even in the country. So that was an extreme panic moment for us. We didn't know who he's gone with, where he's gone. It was absolute fear within us. Like I still remember that. I don't think, you know, we didn't even sleep a wink.
Mariam says a family member managed to get in touch with the boys, who said that they instantly regretted their decision and got on the next flight home.
I mean, he's never left the country. The only time he'd gone abroad was with me and my family when we were like 5 and 3, he was at the time. So for him to make that move, it was a big, drastic move. Anyway, he comes home and, you know, absolutely ashamed of his decision, regretted like the upset that he caused within the family. But we promised to move past that.
But it was too late for Hubeib and Navid. In the eyes of the law, the crime had already been committed. The country had been on high alert for terrorism ever since 7/7, when four suicide bombers with rucksacks full of explosives killed themselves and 52 others in London.
Our family home then got raided approximately a month later. At the time of the raid, we weren't sure why, who they're after, but I still remember sitting in my front living room in my parents' home and they were flicking the documents and I saw my brother's picture. So he wasn't arrested at that point in time, but our family home was raided. And again, I can't recall if they even had a warrant or not, but that was an extremely difficult time. It was the first time we've ever had to go through anything as such, being involved with police and the counterterrorism unit. Like, who are all these people? I was in final year of my university. They wanted to take my laptop. And I was like, what are you doing? I've just come off my placement year. I've got my dissertation to write. They still took it. And then our legal team had to fight to get that back. It was absolutely traumatic, the whole ordeal. Just our family home being raided. I've got my three little younger sisters looking at us like, what's going on? They were only in school. It was absolutely devastating. And just the encounter with racist police officers at the time as well. Just their behaviour and language towards us. I remember we were sent an incorrect letter. I think it was for Navid. And it had Hubeib's name on it, or vice versa, and the addresses were wrong and they live right next door. And we just called to say, oh, you've sent this in error. And the officer made a comment to me to say, it's not nice, is it? Your door's getting kicked down. And I was literally, what, only in my early 20s then? And I was like, what? Like, what is going on? Eventually, he was then arrested and taken to trial, and then he was charged with the intention to attend a training camp, and I think he was imprisoned to around 40 months or so. I still remember that time. We were so shaken up as a family. I was so upset. There were many times where I used to just cry, like, where is he? Why is he not home? And it's that automatic connection that you have if you've got siblings, and if anyone's close to their siblings, like, it's a piece of your family that's missing, who's no longer with you. What's going on? And the whole ordeal of when he had returned, like, you know, I could tell that he totally regretted what he'd done. And from my perspective, he hadn't physically committed any crime.
After his 40-month sentence, Hubeib was released on licence. This means he was still serving a sentence, but living in the community instead of being in prison. Mariam says this made it really hard for him to find work. She says that anywhere he'd go, he'd have that stain on him, that he wouldn't pass any credit checks. He needed a basic type of employment that didn't require an enhanced level of security or qualifications. So when he was contacted by a man called Vincent and recruited to work for a courier service in central Birmingham, it seemed like the perfect solution. The firm was called Hero Couriers and offered £100 a day, cash in hand, to drive up and down the country, reuniting lost air luggage with its owners. In his current struggle to find work, it was an offer he couldn't turn down. Hubeib worked there for a month, at which point his friend and neighbour Navid Ali was also recruited by Vincent. Navid drove his sister's car to work at the unit on his first day. But an hour later, the three MI5 officers I mentioned at the beginning of this story arrived and discovered a bag in his car containing a handgun. When the trial begins, there's a lot at stake for the jury. The day the prosecution opens its case, a man drives a car into pedestrians on Westminster Bridge, injuring more than 50 people. Four people die. He crashes and fatally stabs an unarmed police officer before being shot. This is the first of a number of terrorist attacks that are to take place during the trial. In May, 22 people are murdered at an Ariana Grande concert at Manchester Arena. The following month, eight people are killed when a van is driven into pedestrians on London Bridge. And later that month, a man drove his van into a crowd of Muslims outside Finsbury Park Mosque, killing one person and harming nine. Mariam says it had a huge influence on the case.
There were a series of attacks that year. It's 2017. So it was a dark year. I think there was a lot of fear within the public. Well, if you were a jury member, for example, and you were expected to attend that trial and you've got a terrorism case right in front of you being played out by the CPS of however they wanted to play it out, And then you've got live terrorism attacks happening on your doorstep. How are you able to stay objective and removed from that?
Days at trial are devoted to what is described to the jury as mindset evidence. The evidence of long-standing radical violent ideology, the judge explains, comes from their membership of extremist Telegram groups, messages relating to jihad and the quoting of Arabic songs known as nasheeds. The songs he's referring to were in Arabic, which the men don't speak. In other words, he was saying they became radicalized by songs which they couldn't even understand. But aside from this mindset evidence, there was no concrete evidence, no forensics that linked the men to the bag.
So the route to verdict for this case, if you were a jury member, the exam question that you had to answer was, does this bag belong to Navid Ali? You were not able to do that because there's no evidence presented today that says any of those items were either purchased by any of those four men or belong to them, or were they seen carrying it.
From the very start, Navid Ali insists that the bag was planted. So Gareth Pearce, the lawyer representing the men, is tasked with finding out if that was the case, how and when did it happen. Before the trial began, she had received an email from the Crown Prosecution Service requesting a short extension to the deadline for serving evidence. When the evidence does arrive, there's a witness statement from the proprietor of the courier company where Khabib and Navid worked. The statement said,
"I am a serving law enforcement officer currently engaged in undercover operations. For the purposes of the covert operation I was deployed on, I was known as Vincent."
It turns out that Hero Couriers was a front for an undercover police operation set up with the sole purpose of luring in Khabib Hussein.
Just to put it on record, we weren't aware that this was a fake operation at the start. So it was only 3 months into the arrest that our legal team were eventually told that this was a fake operation. Again, by just by coincidence and chance, because it was leaked in some papers.
The hope was that he would then incriminate himself as he chatted to co-conspirators while running errands fabricated by the undercover officers. But it didn't work. So after 4 weeks, the net was widened and the undercover officers recruited Navid Ali too. It's on his first day of work at Hero Couriers that MI5 arrived to arrange the surveillance of his car and discover the bag. And if I was advising, the exposure of the undercover operation is huge for the legal team representing the Birmingham Four. Until this point, was the Crown Prosecution Service prepared to let the trial proceed on the basis that Hero Couriers was a legit business? Were they going to keep the role of the undercover police concealed? The undercover officer, known as Vincent, becomes the key prosecution witness in the trial, but gives evidence from behind a screen. Due to the operation being undercover, his identity is protected. And then, the prosecution is forced to release a 38-page phone log of the text between Vincent, his boss, and the other undercover officers that were part of the operation. There are more than 1,000 supposedly deleted texts recovered, going back to Khabib Hussein's recruitment a month prior to the raid. After one read of the document, you would think the credibility of this undercover operation was completely blown apart. The message trail reveals that the undercover officers had been in constant contact throughout the trial, despite assurances to the court that they hadn't. This, the defense lawyers argue, is clear evidence of perjury.
They were absolutely, you know, lying in trial, meeting up when they shouldn't be speaking to each other, meeting at lay-bys, at service stations, at hotels. Regardless, anyway, at a point in time, with our defence team putting pressure, several text messages were released. And if you read those text messages, honestly, they are so damning.
Mariam draws out the 38-page phone log of the text between Vincent, his boss, and the other officers, which they had been forced to disclose during the trial.
If I just read this one, following on from our conversation. "Really need some DNA forensics to link Khabib Hussein and Navid Ali. Now, if that's not obvious, what is?" This text message is really disturbing as well. As you know, I'm working tomorrow, and I think I'm right in saying that this will be the first time you have covered me since becoming a newly qualified cover. I feel I must warn you that there are certain things you need to be aware of. I cannot, under any circumstances, be trusted with any of the following: small children, guns, loose women, £50 notes, strippers, massage parlours, any nightclub in Prague or Liverpool, bold women, and then in brackets is put, they really turn me on, any car that will exceed 170 miles per hour, any five-star hotel, any of my three passports, Jacob's Creek, sparkling Shiraz, Dalmore Cask Strength Whiskey. And that just shows you the nature of these officers. Why would you say you can't trust me with small children? And then just flaunting the fact that they've got three passports. Who are these officers? Why are they able to get away with basically anything and demonstrating that they're above the law?
Other messages just seem plain incriminating, such as this one, when the officers sound like they're talking about breaking back into Hero Couriers after the arrests.
This is a message. So when I mentioned to you that he was breaking in, none of those keys fit the padlock, cannot get in. Any inspiration before we get any angle grinder, or I have a set of bolt croppers. So why was it that panic to, you know, get back into the unit? Destroy evidence? Yes, most likely. Because to date, can you believe these men were under undercover surveillance for many months, right? So if you're under surveillance, are you telling me that the police have set up this operation and we've got no CCTV? Not from the public area. So this unit was in Birmingham City Town Centre and not even inside the unit.
There are some messages where the officers appear to make fun of the men.
This text message here: I'm even more determined to put in an Oscar performance when I get in that box. They have never seen me give evidence. I won't let you down. And that's exactly what they did. And then this text message here: we are getting older, but not too old to twirl them and put them away for a long time.
And what do you think they meant by that?
That for me just shows the types of officers again involved in this case were no dissimilar to probably those that were involved in the Birmingham Six. And that bit there, twirl them and put them away, that's really, really, really sad to hear.
Mariam's document goes on and on. I ask her why she decided to go through the text messages, interpreting each one line by line.
Just so you're in a position to be able to answer any questions that anyone has. And I found over the years campaigning, again, I'm not no detective, and honestly, I haven't gone through everything line by line, but I've gone through the majority. Yeah, you have to, unfortunately. This could be a full-time job. Yeah, it probably is, to be honest with you. It would probably break some people.
I get the feeling that Mariam feels she needs to be prepared for anything in case someone comes asking. It's like she feels that no one is on her side. What is the overall message that you take away from these text messages?
I think that's the evidence. I think that's the evidence proving that Vincent planted the bag.
The defence team believe that they have exposed that the Birmingham Four were convicted on the basis of a plant by corrupt police officers. For a moment, there seems to be a glimmer of hope for them. That was until the discovery of the DNA. 3 months into the trial, the prosecution has a major breakthrough. They reveal forensic evidence linking Khabib Hussein to the bag in Ali's car. When the MI5 officer opens the drawstring JD Sports bag, he sees a magazine taped to the handle of a pistol. Hussein's DNA has been discovered on the adhesive side of the tape. But where had it come from, when there was previously no forensics linking the men to the bag? The lawyer representing the Birmingham Four suggests that the DNA could have been obtained by pressing the adhesive side of the tape to the steering wheel of the car which Khabib Hussein had driven to work. In other words, fabricating the evidence. But how would the undercover officers have accessed the inside of Navid and Habib's cars? Mariam was keen to show me the unit where the undercover operation was. She says there's a wealth of evidence there that discredits the undercover officer's story. So we jumped into her car and drove about 15 minutes into Birmingham city centre.
And you get to speak to him every day, you said?
Yeah.
As we drive, she tells me about the history of the area, that it was once a popular spot for Irish emigrants, but is now home to a large Muslim population. It's also the namesake of one of the most famous miscarriages of justice in living memory, the Birmingham Six. We arrive at Florence Street in central Birmingham. It's a scruffy side road right in the middle of town where there are mechanics and garages operating. Only one of the units is shut off. Number 14, once home to the fake operation Hero Couriers.
So we are literally here now on Florence Street.
And you can see like every unit's got their own cameras. We're in prime Birmingham city centre. There would be a lot of CCTV footage. So either it was retrieved because everyone was told to evacuate, they had full access to all the buildings and potentially content was deleted. You can see there as well, like number 14's got its own camera.
Every unit has a surveillance camera.
Yeah, some type.
And you can see that there is double yellows on the side of the road, and there's a vehicle there actually who's got a ticket.
This is an important detail. When Navid Ali arrived at the unit in his sister's car on his first day of work, he was met by Vincent. As Mariam says, there were double yellow lines outside and no parking available. So Navid handed his car keys to Vincent, who offered to park it inside the lockup.
Navid would have arrived here and handed his keys to Vincent to park his car. He then would have left for work. And it was around an hour and 20 minutes where Vincent was alone with Navid's car. And that's the time we fully believe he used that as an opportunity to plant the JD sports bag that was found in Navid's car. And during that morning, the MI5 was scheduled to come and I believe bug Navid's car to fit in tech or to remove tech. I'm not sure which way around. But that's when the discovery of the so-called bag was found.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is because obviously they were under surveillance. And like I mentioned, these men were under surveillance for months and there's no evidence of them planting anything, planning anything, any incriminating type of evidence.
So then there was a raid where they found this.
So
Navid had handed over the keys and given Vincent full access to his car for an hour and 20 minutes as he ran fabricated errands for Hero Couriers, returning fake luggage to fake customers across the country. This is the same way the defence team believe Vincent got hold of Habib's DNA to link him with the bag inside of Navid's car.
With the DNA, the story is really interesting. So my sister and Habib shared a car and Habib used to often go to Hero Couriers, which was the undercover officer's operation and where he was recruited. And he was either dropped off by my sister or Habib would take the car himself. Nevertheless, they shared the car. There was a partial DNA found on some item in the bag, which actually was more my sister's. And what our legal team believe is that, you know, most likely it would have been Vincent who would have been with Habib's car on his own several times. They were encouraged to park inside the unit and Navid and Habib both have given Vincent the keys willingly, without any hesitation. And we think he would have taken a tissue from the car and wiped, let's just say, Gareth Pearce's, maybe the steering wheel, to import my sister's DNA. Yeah. So actually, it was my sister's DNA more than my brother's.
4 weeks after the raid, Vincent had messaged an undercover colleague saying, "It's a sticky tape story. You were right."
Now, if that's not obvious, what is? Can you believe these men were under undercover surveillance for many months, right? So if you're under surveillance, are you telling me that the police have set up this operation and we've got no CCTV?
I think back to some of the text messages that Mariam read out to me.
Really need some DNA forensics to link Hubeib Hussein and Navid Ali. I'm even more determined to put in an Oscar performance when I get in that box. Really need
they
some
have
DNA
never seen
forensics
me give evidence.
To link Hubeib Hussein
I won't let you down.
Navid Ali. We are getting older, but not too
I'm even
old
more determined
to put in an Oscar performance when I get in
time.
That box. I think that's the evidence. I think that's the evidence proving that Vincent planted the bag.
After her brother became a convicted terrorist for a second time and was handed a life sentence, Mariam began a campaign to overturn his conviction. They had one chance to appeal the decision, but it was swiftly denied in what she describes as a mockery of the system. But she's not going to give up on her brother.
We've had film screenings, we've launched a petition. In between that time, we hired an investigator. The role wasn't fulfilled how we had imagined. We lodged complaints to the IOPC, to West Midlands Police Crime Commissioner. We tried to talk to our local MPs. We've just not been successful. And in 2024, March, Gareth has submitted an application to the CCRC. And we are waiting to see how that unveils.
The CCRC, that's the Criminal Cases Review Commission, set up after the wrongful conviction of the Birmingham Six to ensure that another miscarriage of justice like it could never happen again. Hubeib's application has been sitting in their system for over 2 years now. The CCRC is the last possible route to getting the case referred back to the Court of Appeal. The only hope, you might say. But to submit an application to the CCRC, you need new evidence, which is a problem for Mariam. Because, as she says, there was never any evidence that linked her brother to the crime in the first place.
How can we produce new evidence when the existing evidence does not exist to incriminate any of the men, and the existing evidence points towards the undercover officers? And if the officers were not investigated the same way you and I would be investigated, how can we come up with some new evidence miraculously? It's all there. And that's what we're arguing and that's what we're campaigning. So we need to see the CCRC still doing its job in a way that they've got powers to go and investigate these officers, to get access to material that we didn't have access to. So that's what we're hoping that CCRC is able to follow through. But actually, there's an element of me that always says, if you took this case back to trial today, and you were just to base the decision on what the prosecution presented, then there is no case to answer. They should be home because they're innocent.
I ask Mariam what keeps her going after all these years and so many setbacks.
I don't think I have a choice. I think you have to be very strategic and smart when you're campaigning, and you have to keep fighting. And I guess as well, because I've never really had an opportunity to stop. There's always something going on. And I would regret, not being productive for this cause. I'm really passionate about this. It's what I'm fighting for is the principles of justice and having a just world for everyone. Of course, it impacts my brother, but it impacts three other men as well. And they shouldn't be in prison. And we're losing, our precious time with each and every one of them. Yeah, and I just can't wait till the day that they're home.
Mariam has collected every single piece of evidence that she can from the trial to prove that her brother didn't do this. For example, how the men were under surveillance for months, but there was no evidence to suggest that they were planning the attack that the CPS accuses them of. Despite being in a central Birmingham location with CCTV all around, There was no footage disclosed from the unit. There was no purchase history linking the men to the contents of the bag, and none of the men were ever seen with it. The fact that there are still unknown fingerprints on the bag which do not match any of the Birmingham Four, but cannot be traced to the undercover officers as they are still unknown to us, protected by their undercover status in the operation. The list goes on and on. But to this day, the Birmingham Four languish in jail, with the CCRC as their only hope of ever getting out. In the next episode, we explore the case of a man convicted of murder, despite the fact that he was in prison when the killing took place.
You know, it's impossible to be ringing to involve yourself in something you have no foreknowledge of. That just, unless you're psychic, that can't happen.
When I contacted West Midlands Police about the allegations made in this episode, they said, in 2017, all four men were unanimously found guilty by a jury. In 2018, Judge Honourable Mr Justice Openshaw rejected their leave to appeal, saying, in my judgment, there was abundant evidence of Navid Ali's extreme jihadist beliefs to the effect that it was his duty to attack those whom he considered to be unbelievers in this country. The exchange of messages in the heavily encrypted Three Musketeers Telegram group account and elsewhere were only explicable upon the basis that he was plotting an imminent attack. A partially made pipe bomb was found in his van. He answered no questions in interview and did not give evidence to give any explanation for the many incriminating pieces of evidence against him. In my judgment, the evidence against him was overwhelming. The conviction is safe and his application for leave to appeal against conviction is accordingly refused. In 2018, a full court of appeal examined the safety of these convictions in great detail and upheld the findings of the jury, with Lord Justice Holroyd stating, "We have considered whether anything put before us casts doubt on the safety of the convictions. We are satisfied that there is nothing that does so." The jury, by their verdicts, plainly rejected that the evidence had been planted. Having done so, there was ample circumstantial evidence against each of the accused to support the convictions. This series is a production of the Future Justice Project. It's produced and presented by me, Marnie Duke. Executive producers are John Robbins and Callum McRae.